I say, how can somebody fight what he doesn't see? They've kept the facts away from you. They've cheated and deceived every one of you. They filled your heads with filthy lies and kept you in the dark. So that when you finally do wake up, why, we're sorry, but it's just too late. All right. Now, I'm associated with the Patrick Henry Society, which is an organization dedicated to giving the people the truth. What I'm going to tell you is going to make your blood boil. Because I'm going to show you that the way this country is going to go depends entirely and wholly and completely on you.
You said it, Captain!
Neighbor, how long has it been since you had yourself a big hot screaming ear full of forgotten horrors? Well, that's too long. Pull in close now for a crepuscular half hour or so of the Forgotten Horrors Podcast with your hosts, John Woolley, Michael H. Price, and my own self, Wolf Brand Jack.
And thank you, Wolf Brand Jack and Michael H. Price. My name is John Woolley indeed, and welcome to another installment of the Forgotten Horrors Podcast. Michael, it's nice to be back with you again.
Well, I'll tell you what, we always let too much time elapse, but we never fail to pick up where we left off.
And you know, I've got to tell you, I've heard more about the last one that we did, which is about Last Man on Earth.
Yeah.
Just people have been contacting me about that and how much I've enjoyed it. And I think it had something to do with the fact that you talked about your relationship with your distant cousin, Vincent Price, in that.
Good old Vincent.
Good old Vincent. You guys hung out a little bit and had some fun together. Well, this time around, we're talking about a film that has a real monster at its core. And the monster is played by William Shatner. And the monster is a racist. In a film by Roger Corman, a very famous film, maybe became famous for some of the wrong reasons, a famous film called The Intruder. And the reason I think it's famous in the, or it's well known, I suppose, in the Roger Corman canon, is because it is alleged to be the only Roger Corman film that didn't make money. And, you know, Corman had said that he had something to say with this picture. And indeed, he did. It was the first picture he'd ever done at this point in his career, which is 1962, mm-hmm. that he couldn't find a backer for. So he pulled it all together and he had some good reviews. They took it to the Venice Film Festival. It got accepted well there. But he started running it in the States, and The Intruder, the name of the picture, The Intruder just did not work. It did not make money. Now, as I recall, your Uncle Grady, who we've talked about on this program before, the theater man, yes. ran the picture himself, did he not?
Oh, yeah. Grady would run anything Corman did, and he especially liked Grady especially liked getting his hands on a picture that could double as exploitation and art and sometimes social commentary.
Well, this certainly qualifies, doesn't it?
You know, it's funny, the challenge that Corman posed to the rather backwards cultural attitudes that were ranging at large in 1962. Those play out almost quaintly today. I've heard a lot of modern day viewers saying, well, it was certainly a courageous film to make, but isn't it kind of overacted? I said, well, no, not in 1962, it wasn't overacted. It was, you watch a film with the attitude of its day. That goes for silent pictures from the 20s. That goes for Depression period pictures. You got to try to put yourself in the cultural or temporal frame of mind in order to get the most out of viewing any picture you might watch. Mm-hmm. That's what makes every motion picture, in a sense, a documentary, mm-hmm. because it is its place and its time. I find that the picture may have a bit of naivete. It would have been better if say Melvin Van Peebles mm-hmm. had made such a film. Of course, Melvin wasn't working as a filmmaker that early in the game, and it fell to Roger Corman, you know, a white guy with something to say about racial inequality, and he picked up the responsibility, hired clean-cut William Shatner to play the menace, that is, the bigoted rabble-rouser.
Who was right off of Broadway at the time, I believe.
Right, and who had a good track record playing dramatic roles on network television. Mm-hmm. Not yet known for, Star Wars, of course. This was 1962. Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And was not yet known for his broader image as a kind of an avatar of the pop culture. So in a sense, Shatner would have been an unknown at the time and therefore just right for such a role. Mm-hmm. Because today you have the sense of watching a, pardon the expression, iconic actor.
Right.
No such thing for Shatner in 1962, and it served his performance in this film very well.
He did a fine performance in the film, as a matter of fact. Yeah. Great job.
You get the sense that his character is not only bent upon stirring up trouble, but also incapable of dealing with what he stirs up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And with that, not to put too fine a point on it, it has a little bit of resonance for our own time, does it not?
Oh, timing is, and you know, since we first started talking about discussing The Intruder, we find that our own time, while Corman couldn't get a bankroller among the Hollywood studios, how come they're not interested in this picture? And then the inevitable follow through to that is, what do they got to hide? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have had a terrible instance just in the past couple of weeks show up with a publisher called the Folio Society preparing an elaborate volume of the early wartime and slightly pre-war Marvel comics, hired Art Spiegelman, our old pal from the underground comics days,
sure, yes.
To write a scholarly introduction, which Art does well, and to write it from a standpoint of not being a fan of superhero comics, a perfect combination. And in his essay, Art basically called attention to the fact that Captain America was punching Hitler in the snoot before the outbreak of, before the U.S. entry into World War II. Mm-hmm. And then he makes a reference to the Red Skull being a recurring villain even in the Marvel movies. And then he makes the rather innocent kind of glib reference to the modern day situation of what he called the Orange Skull. Who should step in upon seeing that or having that called to their attention but Marvel Comics? You can't run that.
Ah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I have a feeling that a lot of the theatrical circuits blackballed The Intruder in its day for saying similar things. Well, we're not racists down south. Like, if you have to say you're not, then you probably are.
It's kind of like saying, if you have to say that you're cool, you're not cool.
There you go. Exactly. Right. And we've discussed this on prior occasions. The first words out of a true bigot's mouth usually will be, well, you know, I'm not prejudiced or anything, but.
But, that's right. Well, and to summarize, because Joy likes, our producer Joy Hamrick likes to keep us on task. To summarize the show, yeah, we can ramble a little bit. To summarize, the intruder, William Shatner plays a character named Adam Kramer, who gets off the bus in a southern town where integration has begun and starts whipping up the populace. That's really all anybody needs to know, I think, about the plot of the picture. He is a bigot. He is allegedly with the Patrick Henry Society. He says things like, this group is headed by a Jew who hates America. He says things like, we want to see my country stays free, white, and American.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, Roger Corman, who produced and directed the picture, juxtaposes this with the struggle of the black students to be integrated in the white school and how, mostly from a white point of view, the populace feels about it. And it's got so many echoes, Michael. It's got echoes, everything from our friend Dave Friedman's 2000 Maniacs, All the King's Men, to Grapes of Wrath. I'm from Oklahoma, and to me, you know, in this picture, the black students and their parents are the Okies. It's got so many different, so much resonance, and it's got a Twilight Zone resonance because it was written by Charles Beaumont, who was also, of course, a Twilight Zone guy. He wrote the novel. And in the picture are Twilight Zone writers. I mean, William F. Nolan is in it. George Clayton Johnson's in it. Yeah. And Frank Robinson. And, you know, I was at Pulp Fest recently, the Pulp magazine convention.
I talked about that.
And I was talking to a friend of mine named Don Hutchison, a wonderful guy from Canada. And we both were friends of Frank Robinson. And Frank Robinson is a guy who wrote The Power, you know, that was the ended up being the George Powell film with Richard Carlson, and also wrote the book that became the Towering Inferno film. Mm-hmm. And he told me, I was telling him we were going to do this film for our next podcast, and Don said, well, you know, Frank Robinson told me about being down there. And Frank, actually, I had breakfast with Frank at one of the Pulp Fest years ago. He told me about being down there, and they were actually shot in Missouri in the boot heel between Arkansas and Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank told me how it was palpable, that the tension in the air. And he said he did not, unlike Charles Beaumont, and George Clayton Johnson and William F. Nolan, who actually had characters. All that Frank Robinson did was he played one of the Ku Klux Klan members.
Yeah.
And he said at one point they were shooting and they took a break and he really had to hit the bathroom, and they had these porta potties.
Uh-huh.
And he went at the porta potty in his full KKK regalia. And he walks out, unlocks, and throws open the door, and there's a black guy waiting to come in.
Oh.
And he said it was one, Don told me, Frank said it was one of the most uncomfortable and strange situations he'd ever been in. And that was around East Prairie, Missouri, Charleston, Missouri, is where they shot all of this.
Right.
And at one point, they were run out of town by the police. And Corman had to sneak back in and get some establishing shots. And when the film did not do well, which it didn't, and it was re-released on the exploitation circuit under several different titles, or a couple of different titles. I Hate Your Guts was one of them. Shame was one of them. Uh-huh. But Corman said after that, according to Ed Naha's book, The Films of Roger Corman, Corman said, I decided I would never again make a movie that would be so obviously a personal statement. I would never go to the audience directly with my feelings. He said he would instead put his what he thought and felt in a subtextual context.
Oh, Corman's always been great with allegory.
Absolutely, he has. You know, and those, remember those nurse and cheerleader and pictures that he would do? And it would always, he would have so much polemic in it, but as long as some starlet popped her top about every 10 pages of script, he could do it, right?
Well, of course he could. It, you know, and you go back to the earlier Cormans and you'll find, well, perhaps it's just my perception, but I would say that Attack of the Crab Monsters says about as much as George Orwell said in 1984.
Very interesting. You want to go into that a little bit more? Because I think it's an interesting idea.
Mind control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
About the infiltration of the, well, in this case, the human species by otherworldly intellects. Mm-hmm. And is that not what Orwell was about to an extent? Perhaps, Corman, even the intruder does not preach. It merely depicts.
No, it doesn't. And boy, has it got some good performances. I think it's as good as Leo Gordon has ever done.
And Leo's really powerful. Yeah.
Now, he plays a character that looks like he's just going to be sort of some simpleton redneck at the very beginning. But he turns out to be a very rich character.
He's got layers.
Very layered character. Yes, absolutely. And he is married to Jeannie Cooper, the actress, who's also very good in this, whom Shatner has an affair with. And he goes in at one point, you remember, in the hotel room, and he says to Jeannie Cooper, "Are you hot?" And that's pretty, you know, for 1962, the scene that they have together, the seduction scene that they have together, is a pretty racy number.
Oh, it's got some steam in it.
Mm-hmm, it absolutely does. And, you know, he is just, he's really, really good at portraying, Shatner I'm talking about, portraying this character who is all glib on the outside, but on the inside, he is just pathologically self-absorbed, you know, pathological narcissist.
Yep.
And who is using all of this just to, for self-aggrandizement. And again, this resonates so much, not to put too fine a point on it, because we don't want to get political, but it resonates so much with our time, doesn't it?
Doesn't it, though? I'm quite the believer in resurrecting pictures from as far back or as near in time as you can get them, and rephrasing constantly. Sometimes you find most, perhaps, pictures are mere relics, but not beyond enjoyment. Some pictures you find, like this intruder, still have something to say, and probably will always have something to say.
Yes.
Given the warlike nature of the human species.
Right. And, you know, the thing about it is you can find a lot of these films, it's unprecedented that you can find so many of these films for free, like The Intruder, which you can find on, where you can find that?
YouTube.
On YouTube. Yeah, right.
It's a good print on YouTube, yeah.
Print on YouTube. Matter of fact, that's the one we watched before we did this thing.
Yes.
And we also want to mention, before we leave the picture, we want to mention Frank Maxwell, who plays the newspaper editor. Everybody's going to look at him, and they're going to say, gosh, I know that guy, especially if you're a baby boomer, because he was on so many different TV shows as a kind of an authority figure, an editor or a CEO or something. And he's really good in this. Corman had a knack for picking people who were just going to be really good at what they did. And Leo Gordon, who of course was associated with Corman, two, three decades?
Correct.
Yeah. Is just as good as you want to get here. He doesn't necessarily steal a show from Shatner because it's Shatner's show, But boy, he really does a good job. Every time he is on screen, you focus in on him.
That's right.
So I think that we would both recommend this picture. Great deal.
Multiple viewings
would not hurt.
Every time, yeah.
That's right. And I will say, in when we consider Shatner's character, but also just in general, the Eric Hoffer, the old longshoreman philosopher, his statement, that famous statement of his that I thought of when I was watching, when Joey and I were watching The Intruder, rudeness is the weak man's imitation of strength. And I think that is part of the thing that's behind, that kind of fuels The Intruder to me. That whole, Shatner's inherently a very weak character, but he just pushes and is just, it rudely inserts himself into things. The weak man's imitation of strength. So we recommend it. I'm not going to speak for you, but I suspect that you do.
Definitely. Roger Corman told me in 1999, I think it was, that whatever misgivings he may have had about the commercial failure, he said The Intruder is the picture that he prefers to be remembered for.
Well, if he'd only done The Intruder, he'd be remembered, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a terrific film.
Definitely.
You know, of course, I love the Beverly Garland monster movies too, but this is a terrific picture. Now, let's get to plugging. What do you got out there that people might want to buy?
Well, we've got the entire Forgotten Horrors catalog just sitting right there on Amazon, right for the picking. I am, in fact, working on polishing off 13 of the Forgotten Horrors books.
My gosh, really?
Bringing that series into the new linoleum, I mean millennium, and covering pictures of the early 2000s. Century. I figured, we've published reviews on many pictures that fit the categories of mystery, suspense, and even outright horror film. And why not take them out of the limbo of long-gone newspapers and syndicate transmissions and get them into a new volume of the Forgotten Horrors books. So it's nice when a book writes itself, you know?
Yes, it is. And it's nice when people who listen to this podcast go to Amazon.com or wherever, and pick up on the books. And we've seen that happens. And we want to thank the folks for wanting to get more into what we're talking about, what we write about.
Yeah, and it keeps us in business.
Yeah, it does keep us in business. It absolutely does. And speaking of weird pictures, Michael, we have a picture coming up. Well, let me go ahead and say that we're very happy that Fantasies in the Sand, kind of, I guess we'd call it a Forgotten Horror spinoff, has been doing so well. People have been picking it up, and I've been hearing about it. We really appreciate that. Also want to mention my novel. It's the first in a trilogy. It's called Seventh Sense. We would like to check that out as well. And the second one, which I believe will be called Satan's Swine, will be coming out in the next month or two. And the second one in that trilogy is set in 1939 with a WPA folklore project writer up in the Arkansas hills that runs into a nest of witches. So if you enjoy horror stories, and especially horror stories, as you said in your wonderful flap copy you did for the first issue, or the first book, that inspired by weird tales and the pulps of that era. Take a look at it and give it a shot. Meanwhile, now, the next film we're going to talk about is a film you picked from your friend, Bill Paxton.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a film called Taking Tiger Mountain. And this is going to be a little bit of a departure for us, isn't it?
It's about the weirdest film we've ever discussed, except then I remember the bed that eats people.
The bed that eats people may not be the bed that eats people, exactly.
It may not be that weird, but it is a, well, you know, what do you expect when you take a fragment of a story by William S. Burroughs, mm-hmm. put a 19-year-old Bill Paxton, pre-Hollywood, in it, and then kind of release it during the early 80s. That would be before Bill broke out in Weird Science.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of withdraw it from circulation. And then in the present day, that is 2019, you get that footage whipped all into new shape, hit some new camera crew footage to bookend the story. And what do you got? Well, you got Taking Tiger Mountain Revisited.
And we are going to just go all over it in our next podcast, are we not?
I wouldn't have it any other way.
Michael, thank you. It's been real. And folks, thank you for listening to the Forgotten Horrors podcast. Tell your friends if they're weird enough to want to join us. We'd appreciate that.
Delighted.